Very, very explicitly kind of says the view I have no self is a problem. So if you ever, if you doubted that, you thought it was just making this up, that the Buddha was somehow anti no self view, here you have it in the horse's mouth. Or be careful what I say, I suppose. So here we have this idea of the frames of reference being shifted. He's saying that there's certain questions you can ask, which are very common for us, very kind of automatic, or maybe kind of almost seemingly intuitive to ask questions like, who am I? Was I in the past? Who will I be in the future? What's going to happen to me? What am I? These are very basic questions of human beings asked. And in fact, in some spiritual circles and practices, these are some of the very central questions, you know, who am I, what am I, are asked. I don't know if what the Buddha is saying here is that these are probably not useful categories for examining our experience. And maybe what we're going to do is not to try to answer these with some of the various kinds of views that we can be attached to, but rather to shift the frame of reference, shift the question, in other words, that we're trying to address, away from the question of self to something else. That perhaps any question framed by the word self is going to lead to some misconception, and probably going to lead to some conceit. So we have to be careful, very careful, with the kind of questions we ask. If you ask, you know, who is a true self? Who am I? Or what am I? That it might not lead to useful answers is I think the suggestion here. So for the purpose of Buddhist spiritual life, you don't want to ask those questions, which seems very odd to people who are used to asking those questions, and seems like it's very reasonable to ask those questions, but rather you ask something different. And you turn around and you ask, so in the last paragraph, He does not attend to ideas unfit for attention. And he tends to ideas fit for attention. So he shifts the frame of a reference. What are the questions? What are the ideas? What are the frame of reference which is appropriate? This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the stopping of suffering. This is the way leading to the ending of suffering. So suffering or dukkha, stress, becomes the question. You know, what is the suffering here? What is the cause of the suffering, and what is the ending of it? So the therapeutic purposes of Buddhism come to the highlight as a frame of reference. We study our life by studying where is the suffering here, rather than studying where is the self here. What is the true self here? We say, where is the suffering here? And then Buddhist practice is to go directly into the suffering. Not to dwell in suffering in some morbid way, but rather to see suffering, see the cause of suffering, and experience the ending of that suffering. And what the Buddha is suggesting is that's a useful frame of reference. That's a useful approach to studying your life. So it's dropping the category of self entirely, which is always going to be, I would suggest, a concept, a categorical category imposed on top of experience in favor of paying attention to some particular aspect of our direct experience, which is always in a sense we can say kind of real. The self as a concept is not real, because concepts are not real in and of themselves. They're useful as concepts, but what's real in a sense, if we allow to talk about, use that language, is our suffering. And if you're feeling like you're suffered, that's as real as anything's going to get. So it's, you know, it means you want to deny its reality. That's okay with me, but let's just define that as the benchmark for some reality. Your suffering is something you can directly experience. And so you start, you want to keep focusing on what can be directly experienced, because the purpose of Buddhism is to become free of your suffering. And since suffering gets born based on our relationship to the world of experience, It's in the world of experience that we can become free of suffering. So we don't need to posit some self or some reality beyond our experienceable world. There's no need for that in Buddhism. There might be such a thing, but there's no need for that, because the domain of suffering and freedom of suffering comes from in the very domain itself of experience. And one of the central categories of experience, or focuses of experience, is suffering. Now, does that make sense, what I said?
Yeah.
So, questions, Jim?
Yeah, I noticed the first letter being identity view. So, this is about right view then. Is that correct? That identity view would be wrong view? Is that?
The first one being I have a self. Where are you?
Well, I was at the end where he was talking about the three feathers being abandoned.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. So, his identity view being this framing of self being wrong view?
Yes. I think so. Or identity view is the view that there is an existing self. So, the view that there is no self is also... discussion of right view is that right view is understanding the Four Noble Truths, and understanding how to use the Four Noble Truths as categories of reference, as frames of reference for understanding our experience. So the Four Noble Truths is not meant to be a view in terms of a metaphysical view of what's true and what's not true. It's rather categories for helping us focus on our direct experience. So our direct experience is quite varied, quite wide, ranging. There's a lot of things we pay attention to. As the Buddha said, it's particularly useful to pay attention to this particular aspect of the direct experience, the suffering and the freedom of suffering. This is not a general formula. What he's saying here is that, just stay with whatever you've got to experience. I think what he's saying is that these particular aspects of what you're doing are particularly useful to attention. So you don't want to just pay attention to, freely to anything in the world, but this is particularly useful. So, meditative experience. Say there's a lot of peace in your meditation practice. If a person focuses on the peace, it might sustain the peace a little bit longer. It might not. It might be useful to recognize it. It might strengthen it. It might predispose a person to have more peace in the future. There certainly is a time to really be mindful of the peace. But at some point, the person wants to turn their attention and start noticing, where is the subtle clinging? Where is the subtle stress or the subtle suffering, even in that very deep state of peace? because it's the suffering which is going to be in a sense, maybe the tip of the iceberg for where clinging still exists. And so, and where the cutting edge of your practice needs to be. And so you want to then look around, see where am I still suffering, where there's still some holding, some attachment, and then look at that and address that directly. And what you'll find is that that point of suffering is still an area where you're relating to something which is conditioned, some fabricated, it's something that's been created, an assumption or something, some clinging. And then because you're addressing it, and you let go of that. So as things get more and more subtle in meditation, then you're able to address more and more subtle areas of clinging. And for some people, it's only in very deep still meditation that they might actually directly be able to perceive the clinging and the suffering connected to I am. In normal everyday life, you know, I am is such an easy, natural thing to assume that you don't necessarily, I mean, you're suffering because of taxes, you know. You know, who could care? You know, taxes, you know, way overshadow what's going on with, you know, I am. But once, you know, you're on retreat long enough and you've forgotten your taxes, you've forgotten your bills, you've forgotten, you know, all these things, you know, and you actually get very, very still and very quiet, then you see that actually and the suffering inherent in just having the notion I am is seen. And then you want to investigate that. What happens to some people in deep meditation is that they get to a kind of plateau of a lot of peace and whatever, a lot of calm. And then they kind of just hover there for a long time. And a way to go to the next stage is to actually begin looking around and see where is the suffering here? Where is there still some stress and some clinging? And that can move you on. And finally, it'll move you on to what Tanisara Bhikkhu calls the unbinding, the final release, the final letting go of any kind of clinging at all. So another way of saying what the Buddha said here, I hope, is that if you want to simplify your practice as being and making it most direct and most straightforward, you would use these questions or these frames of reference. You'd pay attention in this way. You pay attention to suffering, the cause of suffering, and all that. If you start negotiating the path from the point of view of self, that sooner or later you're going to reach an impasse where you can't go any further. So what you from the Buddhist critique, which maybe is not a fair critique. They will look at people there are people who will say, now I've discovered my, you know, infinite self, I've discovered my cosmic self, I've discovered, you know, whatever. And from the Buddhist point of view, often when they listen and pay attention to what their meditative experience is, that's giving them that impression, they say, oh, that person is in the seventh or eighth or the sixth or the fifth jhana. A particular form of absorption, which is very rarefied, where consciousness becomes infinite, for example, in the meditation experience. And then they take that meditation experience and then they add an assumption of self to it. Oh, I have an experience of consciousness being infinite. That must be myself. They've added an assumption to it. And then adding that assumption, If you pay careful attention, you'll see that that itself is extra, not needed, and in fact adds a certain level of stress to the whole system. It involves a little bit of clinging. And it's a misunderstanding because the final release hasn't happened. Infinite consciousness still has within it a certain level of clinging. It's very, very subtle. It's phenomenally subtle. But if you look very, very carefully, if the mindfulness is very well developed, then you might be able to see the very subtle dissatisfaction that's part of that experience. And as you include that feeling of dissatisfaction, that it's not enough or not good enough, or kind of, then there can be letting go of that. Sometimes that'll then move into deeper jhanic experience. And sometimes a person will go to the eighth jhana or something even further. Or sometimes they won't go any further into the jhanas, but they'll just jump from that jhana into final release. They just let go of everything. Rather than just letting go a little bit and just going on to the next jhana, they'll let go much more and move beyond meditative world entirely. So I think this is a very important point, and for a few other teachers I know, this is a very important point, that certain questions are useful to address, useful to carry with you, and some questions maybe are not useful to carry with you, and some questions would seem very natural, intuitive to carry with us, and people will bring often to us, you know, to address in their practice, maybe are not so useful. And so maybe what's needed is to jump over to a different frame of reference, to look at our life from a different point of view. Not looking for the true self, but rather looking for the true release from suffering. So from this point of view, any kind of view of self has no point. I mean, it might have some point, but it's not needed. Any view of self, whether you have a self or don't have a self, is no longer interesting to answer. You don't have to answer that question if you're focusing on the Four Noble Truths. And the claim here is the Four Noble Truths will take you the whole way. So, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So I don't have to...
What is the container?
I mean, I should have thought on that. But you know what I mean? I understood everything you said and completely got it.
Yeah.
And then I thought, yeah, you know, and I've had some of those experiences of meditation, and as soon as you bring the self in, it all changes.
Yes.
I mean, it's just amazing how quickly it all changes.
Yes.
But if you let go of the self, you do. You keep flowing and you keep moving and you just experience it.
Yes.
And then if you recognize the fact that there is no self, then the question always comes up for me is, then what's happening?
What's happening?
I mean, what's containing this?
What's containing them?
What is here? What is this experience?
Well, I don't know.
Maybe it is the frame of reference question.
Well, maybe not. See, first of all, it might be interesting for you to explore where that need for understanding what the container is. I mean, question that for a while. Don't just simply naively think, well, I'm going to find the container. Question the question, and question that category, and say, on what authority, on what belief, or what tenet am I basing this question on? Is it a valid, you know, do I have is it on valid authority that I'm even asking that question? So, and it might be, for example, a kind of flat earth question. If you're looking for the end of the earth, because the earth is flat, you know, you're never going to find it because the earth's not flat. But, so if you're looking for the container, you might be asking the same kind of question. It's possible. I'm not saying that's the case, so don't believe me. So I don't want you to let go of that question too quickly. But you might want to look at
it. I've been listening to stuff for like 2 weeks now. Not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Could the container be simply an ever ongoing process?
Yes, I think that's fair to say. So, like the river, it's an ongoing process. So, in a sense, if there's any container, it's this ongoing process of your whole life, which is made up of many different mental and psychological and physical factors that are all working somehow in harmony, working together. And if you try to go and pinpoint it more exactly than that, than an overall process, then you won't find something. That's one possibility. So if you go back to the themes of the day, themes of self and no self, at the bottom of the page is a very famous quotation by Buddha Gosha, who laid down kind of the he's like the Thomas Aquinas of Theravada Buddhism. There is suffering, but none who suffers. There is doing, although there is no doer. Liberation exists, but no liberated person. Although there is a path, there is no goer. although there is an experience like Denise had, there is no experiencer. There's no container. So, you know. Yes, please.
Let's just say that I'm not there yet. You know, in terms of that poem.
The what? Not there?
If you haven't, this to me seems very heavy stuff. But for me, I'm experiencing more. If I wanted to talk to you about my practice, when can I do that? Or are there other people that one can talk to? This is the ideas I have to talk.
I got stunned a little bit there, because I guess you're asking just a very simple, straightforward question, right? Isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Of course, you can talk to me. I'm always available.
Okay. I'm just wondering, you know, like you're available like next Saturday during the retreat, or where do you sign up to talk to you? I don't need to be.
I do two kinds of one-day sittings. The one-day sittings from 8:30 to 5, there's 15-minute interviews that people can sign up for. You have to come early usually. It's like get a slot. Those from 9 to 4:30, there's no formal interviews, but there's usually plenty of open space during the walking meditation to come and talk to me informally. And then outside of those times, I like to see people on retreats. That's my preference. But outside of that, I can see people in my Ivan office in Menlo Park. So you just, you know, give me a call and we'll set up a time. Yes?
One phrase jumped out of the middle.
So someone turn on a light. I don't know where it is, but...
A phrase jumped out in the middle of this. There's an acknowledgement in the middle of this that there is a nowhere.
There's a what?
A nowhere.
Yes. Where is it?
Right in the middle, opposite to number 6 in the margin. This very self of mind, the nowhere that is sensitive here and there.
Yeah.
There to the ripening of good and bad actions. The syntax,
yes.
That exists. The view of it as constant and everlasting is not, is incorrect.
Yeah. Maybe so. Maybe so.
I thought that was one of his
wrong views.
That was one of the wrong views.
This is he's saying that this is not the inappropriate way.
Yeah.
To see it.
It seems to say there is a knower, but it's wrong to think of it as constant.
That's one way of understanding it. The other way of understanding it is that there is knowing. That's for sure. And the Buddhism is never going to deny knowing because it's so central. But then to posit on top of a knowing. A knower, that's extra. There's no need to add that on top. And then from that, then the person gets even more complicated. But, I mean, so, but...
Where is he reading
something? Right next to the 6.
Everything in italics there is a view.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but it's so central to many of us that, you know, we have to grapple with this little bit to really, otherwise we're not going to put down the self, I think. You know, so it's fair to grapple. Okay, so let's go to 7, which I think is the last of the discourse readings.
That is not about
somebody can be seen is not construed as an object that is seen, is not construed as an unseen, is not construed as an object that is seen, is not construed as an object that is seen. How can I know what is happening?
So it may be a little bit hard to understand this because, but you know, when that Tathagata, when a Buddha, someone is awake and sees something, there's certainly seeing happening, but there isn't a positing of an object that's being seen. Now, there isn't a positing that there's no object being seen either. They're just seeing. It seems a little bit odd, this kind of way of talking, but I think that if we try to drop out of normal descriptive language of how we describe our experience, and imagine maybe what would be an experience of grace, an experience of a mystical experience, or experience where radically the self is not being posited, where there's no self-conscious experience of doing anything with the experience, then maybe we get close to what he's talking about here. When he's talking about the consciousness of the experience of someone who's awakened, there is no and I call it, I think, grace, because, you know, you don't see a door as an object. But there certainly is, the person knows what to do with the door. The person still opens the door and walks out. So the person relates to the door as a door is supposed to be related to. But the person doesn't then add on this very, any kind of, there's no additions to it. Just a door is just a door. There's no idea the door is an object either. Of course the door is an object. But there's no, the mind doesn't construct it has an object, and doesn't take the next step of thinking, oh, that door is a door, even though there's a seeing of the door. Does that make any sense? For whom doesn't it make sense? Please, you know. I hope it doesn't make sense to some people, because then I'm confident that...
The thought that occurred to me, I was thinking about children's books, and actually how we learn language is by books with pictures of objects.
Sure.
And so this is kind of a process of learning.
This is similar in the classroom. Every year, I talk to collect the town to watch it happen. When we're doing pressure experiments, and this is with the sixth graders, the kids are about 1 year old. And you do, maybe working with syringes and different sorts of devices to create low and high pressures. And someone will take toilet plungers and push them against the wall. And it will pose the question, well, is it being pulled into the wall or pushed into the wall? Was it being pulled? Is a toilet plunger being pulled in, pushed on? Well, even after a month of experiments, they desperately want to believe that it's being pulled into the wall. And it seems to be a main human response. But at some point, it gets frustrated with something like, oh my goodness, high pressure is trouble so low. Really, you can push on. You cannot be pulling off. In fact, there is no pulling, there is no such thing as suction. And in a rough analogy, your children make this the shift, which I think the Buddha is asking us to make, is that shift away from, don't get hung up on suction, it really doesn't exist. It's a mental construct. It's convenience that really doesn't exist. What really exists is pressure differences that allow things to
happen. Nice. Yes. And perhaps if we translate this into if we translate it into the kind of common relationships with people, is we don't see the person as being a fixed entity, a fixed self, is incapable of changing. So if someone does something mean to you, you don't then always consider them to be a mean person. You don't make them a mean. Now that person's that's a self. Because they're mean once, I'm always going to attach meanness to that self there. But rather we see that the mean activity happen. And let's relate to that, let's be mindful of that, and let's, you know, maybe there's some consequences that you're going to implement because of that one experience. But you're ready to see the person in a fresh way, in a new way. You know? You're not carrying with you some fixed notion of who that person is. You don't want to be blank in the sense of anything goes, you know. Just, you know, that's not wise either. But you want to be mindful of what you can actually experience, what actually happened, and then be mindful of any way in which we add or interpret extra concepts on top of that. So if someone was mean to you, you know, it's bad enough that they were mean, and so just be mindful of that meanness. But then we can add, for example, the notion that's a mean person. And but you don't want to be a blank slate where it says, well, meanness doesn't really exist, and I'm not going to pay attention to it. And, does that make sense? That's what it's all about. Yeah, that's right. That's a nice assumption to have. It's helpful assumption to have. Yeah. Yeah. And but even I mean, but you can get in trouble with that assumption too.
Well, yeah. I mean, you don't want to lose your grip.
Two things to that. One is that I think it's helpful to have a view of open possibility and the possibility of change and development, and not have some view of things are fixed the way they are. And Buddhism is very optimistic about the capacity of human beings to develop themselves and change themselves. And the other is we need to be mindful of what we do in terms of in relationship to ideas of self and self and other. But we don't want to get hung up a little bit where there's no self teaching. You know, we want to be careful. You don't kind of, now you've taken the class and you know all this too well now. I'm no longer going to see a self in that person over there. You know, I mean, the idea always is to be mindful of what you're actually doing, as opposed to just positing some. So now I thought, I got interested in this topic recently again of the anatta when I started trying to see how some of the Western writers and teachers of Buddhism handle the teaching of self and not self. And I found it was very interesting, especially when I got into my own local tradition of the Vipassana movement in America. And I thought it was kind of, some of the things I found is condensed, they're very clearly stated in Jack Kornfield's book, A Path with Heart. And Jack, I think, is a very sophisticated thinker, and much more sophisticated than most people will give him credit to in the, because he's kind of the popularizer of Buddhism also. He likes to kind of, to be evocative, to kind of, to evoke people with beautiful, kind of sugar-coated, wonderful stories and make people feel good. But I think he's someone who's very well studied and very sophisticated in many ways about both Buddhism and also Western thought. So it's not someone, if you're sophisticated yourself, it's very easy to read Jack and kind of discount him. And so he has this wonderful chapter, interesting chapter at least, No Self or True Self, in his book, A Path with Heart. And if you have that book, you might read the whole chapter and see, you know, what he does there. It's fascinating. It raises a lot of questions. And in the opening pages of this, he tries to lay out what he takes to be the Buddha's teaching on anatta, or self. So, why doesn't someone, so under the section called The Nature of Selflessness, why doesn't someone read the first paragraph for us? Now, you've had this whole day now looking at what the Buddha said about this question of self and the issue of anatta. Now, from the perspective of what you studied today, what do you think about Jack's statement here? How does it fit? Not fit? Or what's your reactions to it? Please. Someone else say something else? Reactions or thoughts about it? It's overlaps with Dave, right? Maybe. Yeah, so even if it's kind of similar to what Dave said, you might want to say your reactions or thoughts. The difference. What do you?
This is
Mm-hmm. Okay, someone, that's great, thank you. Someone else? Someone said earlier today that one of the common teachings you find in many of Vipassana teachers and other Buddhist teachers in the West is this idea that anatta means that there's no separate self. And so there is a self, but it's it's an interdependent self. That's how I take the admission of no separate self. It's not saying that the stream of our individuality is we're not referring to the stream of our individuality, but referring to the interconnected nature of nature itself. And so I am not separate from the trees that are making oxygen. I'm not separate from the rain, the sun. That's the way Thich Nhat Hanh talks about it, right? So no separate self means that there's an interdependent self. That's kind of what the logic kind of would imply, right? If there's no separate self, it means that there's a non-separate self. So we still have a self. In one of the readings earlier today, I didn't highlight it when we talked, but there was a passage where he said some people take the self to be the cosmos. And you find the first sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, I think it is, where some people take everything, all existence together to make up the self. And the Buddha says that's also an inappropriate false view. Why would it be a false view to say all the whole universe, the whole cosmos to be the same? is a test. So what's the problem with saying, you know, the self is the entire cosmos? What's one of the problems with that? Is it bliss? And that's right. In addition, there's a question of it's still based on conceit, or still based on the notion of I am, that there is a self. And so it's an assumption and fabrication that's added on top of what's actually there. So not only might be false, but it might also be that it's unneeded. It's an addition and imputation on top of an experience. So we have this expression, no separate self, is very common. And nowhere in the suttas have I ever seen, or even in the Asian Buddhist tradition, have I found any teaching that says that anatta means that there's no separate self. Because if anything, that then I think it implies, the logic of that suggests that there is a self still, just not a separate self. And so you're still left with a self, but it's a non-separate self. He saw into the human tendency to identify with a limited and unlimited self sense of existence, that you can identify with that. And I think any identity is a problem. And a small self is a root delusion. And so some of this language, of course, could be metaphorical, or could be poetic. And so Sue said a small self just means identifying with the five skandhas being the self. But then that very easy one, as soon as you qualify it as a small self as a problem, that could imply...
important to it, that's useful, skillful.
Yeah.
Use for a while. You won't be able to use that. This is a funny story. Dr. Namro, that was a Buddhist society. And he said he didn't know what him was. His wife was a real saint. He used to go around going, it is hungry.
It can drive people crazy, that kind of language.
So, for a lot of people, this is quite useful and quite helpful to think that you're thinking yourself is limited and will make people less greedy. So, it does have a good use.
And what you do find absence in this paragraph, at least, is some of the very particular definitions of self that the Buddha is negating, like in the first sutta, is absent here. Is absent. I mean, the idea that there is no enduring, permanent self. I don't think Jack ever comes across and actually says that, right? So one of the central and early teachings in Buddhism about what is being negated when you negate the self is not self. Jack doesn't say in this section here, and it lends itself certainly, as some people said, very easily to the certain Hindu or Brahmanical teachings about what the nature of the self is. I mean, I can very well imagine a Hindu teacher, maybe even some Advaita Vedanta teachers, saying the same thing as Jack is saying here. And in fact, I think that if you look at the bottom of the page, one master with whom I studied, and he's going to quote someone, he doesn't say who he's going to quote, who he's quoting. If you have the book, you can go home and read it. I didn't. But I'm pretty confident that the person he's quoting is an Advaita Vedanta teacher, not a Buddhist one here. So that's probably fine. I mean, maybe it's not any problem. But, however, it is interesting.
Have you talked to him?
I raised this issue of this chapter with him, and what I've told you about this and how I'm not talking behind his back. I wouldn't have brought this and talked about him this way in the class, since I know him personally. If I didn't know him personally, then it's safe because it's a public work. But I know him personally, so I've already talked to him about this, and so it's okay for me to. I'm not talking behind his back. Oh, he didn't have a particular response to me, he responded to it outside of my hearing to others, and I didn't hear what he said. Yes.
You said earlier that when you haven't heard a good change, you do it every time
you
come out of your corporate meeting.
Yeah.
And we were at the Southeast Church. About how we're doing our teachings about interconnectedness.
Yeah.
And then how the Buddha didn't necessarily teach that in Anjanamara, and what you're saying about telephone, how we read this and think, oh, we've got it, and Jack, Judith, and Chris, and then we've just been a whole group of students in investigating, and Amro's caution was that people would become complacent or comforted with the idea of all this interconnectedness and not go beyond that into the inside and the person, the direct investigation.
Exactly.
And if that's something we need to
I think if you start looking at some of the insight meditation teachers, their writings, you find the teachings on interconnectedness appearing more and more. Very, very important. So for some of the teachers, like the central spiritual vision, at least in their writings, is a vision of interconnectedness. And it seems seemingly in the world-affirming nature of America, the West, interconnectedness is the god of Western Buddhism. It's like one of the great, it's the ultimate good. And it's very comforting for people. And it could be said that in the time of the Buddha, teachings of the Buddha, he certainly recognized that things are interconnected. But rather than interconnectedness being the solution or the answer or the great good, it's the problem that you want to be freed from. And I remember in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the consequence of seeing the five skandhas as not being self is turning away from things. And in meditation, there's talking about seclusion. And in the famous quote in the Mahanibbana Sutta, become an island unto yourself. There's a lot of emphasis in the suttas on not realizing your interdependent nature and staying in interdependence, but rather realizing your independence from things and turning away from things. So, in a sense, maybe it's like, is the glass half full or half empty, or you know, what is useful to say in different cultures to different people. So, we have to be very sensitive that maybe, you know, both people are often corrections for people, and they're all coming back to the middle way. But it's very interesting, at least, to see the radical difference. The conclusion of the Buddha, when he says that the five skandhas are not self, it leads you to separate yourself from things. The conclusion in some of the American Vipassana teachers who realize that there's not self is you're supposed to then, as a consequence of that, realize that you're interconnected. You're supposed to feel more connected, more sensitive. And you find often in the teachings of American Vipassana teachers the idea that the practice is going to lead you to become more sensitive to the world around you, more feeling connected to the world around you. And that's certainly the case. You do that, but it's considered to be kind of almost like the goal of practice. In fact, you find people like Joseph Goldstein writing that basically he says something like, the goal of practice is freedom, and when you attain freedom, you'll be increasingly interconnected. That's what he says. I can quote him directly from his book. So it's almost as if interconnectedness is the ultimate goal, whereas in the teachings of the Buddha, interconnectedness is the world of conditionality. It's a fabricated world. It's the world of conditions, and the deathless is that experience which is beyond the conditioned world, which is another way of saying is beyond the world of connectedness. So if you take the interconnectedness as the ultimate good, you might actually not taking the practice far enough. You might, as Ajahn Amaro says, become complacent and comforted and not take this next step into that which is not connected, which is...
One of the things that I remember saying on that same retreat was that this was kind of like, instead of seeing yourself as the drop of dew, seeing yourself as the ocean. But what Ajahn Amaro said is, it's not then to see yourself as the ocean, but it's just to know the ocean. I mean,
right.
The step is that it's just knowing the ocean is the goal, I guess, or the appropriate action or way to go.
Maybe something like that. But yeah, so certainly any kind of positing that I am in the midst of that experience, for the freedom is not there yet. So say, I am now the ocean, you know, then you're not there. You're not in the ocean.
No real improvement on I am dewdrop.
Yeah. Just, you know, you're not any more or less wet.
With interconnectedness, it seems to me like the concept of that is most useful for the precepts for stimulating, focusing on that and becoming kinder.
I think that
seems, you know, so huge, such a huge important thing. Like Thich Nhat Hanh said that, you know, the one thing he wants in his life is to be kinder by the end of his life. You know, he's had a good life.
Yeah, so I think that the teaching of interconnectedness is very useful, and maybe it has a certain truth to it. I mean, certainly the ecological self, I mean, we can't argue that. There is an ecological self. There's many kinds of self. There's a relational self that arises in relationship to other people. There's an ecological self. And if you read this chapter of Jack's, what's one of the reasons so interesting is that he takes a lot of the different ideas of self that are floating around, And he holds them all together. So rather than seeing them as being opposed to each other, he kind of very brilliantly brings them all together.
Interconnected.
So they all have a place for Jack. And you might argue that Jack just trying to make everything, you know, make everything one or make everything kind of okay. That's his great role in life, is to make everything okay. But it also, I think, it's also maybe very brilliant and very sophisticated to actually not hold things in opposition, but see that there are different areas of life, different notions and concepts of self apply and are appropriate, and that he brings them all together in this ecological self, the psychological relational self, the personal self, the developmental self, you know, the no self, the not self, or whatever. They're all kind of held together here. So I think it's helpful to give Jack the benefit of the doubt, and if you do that, you might see that there's much more going on here than maybe even he realizes. Now, one other thing is, I wanted to say, maybe this is an apologetic for the Vipassana tradition and my friends and myself, is this. I think the real strength of the American Vipassana movement is the orthopraxy of it, is that it really has a very strong practice focus. And that's really what holds it together. And the teaching part of it, I don't think, the different teachers can have different teachings. And different teachers might even have teachings which are different from the Buddha. But the central reliance, central focus is in this very strong strand of practice itself. And some faith and trust in the practice itself is self-correcting. It'll work itself out. So the teachings are supposed to be encouragements to help people practice. But the teachings themselves are maybe not that centrally important. And what's important is for individuals to keep practicing and keep doing that investigation. If you keep doing the investigation yourself, then you'll slowly find the places of holding, the places of suffering. And if your notion of self is a place of suffering, you'll realize that if your mindfulness is strong enough and you let go of that. And Tanisara Bhikkhu, he argues that some notions, even attachments to self, are useful in the early stages of people's practice. And you don't want to be in a hurry to get rid of everyone's attachments to self. If in the early stages of practice they're useful and keep people practicing and give them a healthy sense of self or useful, strong sense of self to kind of carry them along, just that's fine. Work with that and don't take that away from people. At some point, as the practice gets stronger and stronger and they get more and more able to, more and more refined in their mind, at some point it's essential to turn the attention back to the attachment to self. But you don't want to do that, you know, prematurely. So it's very interesting to have this one teacher, at least, who is not quick to deny the existence of the self, but rather works with it with people until a certain point and then has them turn around and look at it. And maybe that's what Jack's doing. You know, after all, this is a popular book. So he's just working with what popular people are. The ordinary, run-of-the-mill person.
If you look in the back of the book, it's classified in the psychology and self-help section. Oh,
no. So it's 5 to 5. Maybe it's okay to stop now. I hope that this has been interesting for you to actually kind of read the suttas, if those of you who haven't, and gotten some sense of this, and hopefully I've been challenged by this and been surprised, and maybe you'll be very careful to ever use the word no self again. and maybe you'll start investigating very honestly how the notion of self and I am operates in the details of your life. So, thank you.
Thank you.
And if some of you, especially those of you who have been here before, could help set up the room again, that would be greatly appreciated.
Thank you. I'm giving away a lot of my books.
Uh-huh.
This is a fairly new book, and I want Tori.
Oh, thank you.
And I thought it would be appropriate.
No.
I don't know if it might be too advanced.
Well, we'll check it first.
Yeah,
oh, thank you. That's very kind.
Sure. It's wonderful today, by the way.
Thank you.